This is Darren Kirapatla from A Difference. I'm attending the Microsoft Innovative Teachers Conference, the first ever that they're having here in Canada, to establish a network of innovative teachers across the country. So the first keynote speaker that they had at the conference this morning was a fellow by the name of Arnold Wasserman, and he's the chairman of the Idea Factory in San Francisco. And he talked about a whole lot of really interesting things. And in this podcast, I think the idea that kind of really grabbed me was the notion of design thinking, which is something that Arnold speaks about at length. I had the opportunity to have a conversation with him after the presentation, and I'll share that a little more, my thoughts about it, after at the end of this podcast. So give it a listen, and if you want to share back anything you thought about it, please feel free to do so right here on the blog.
Company Magazine, and it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Arnold Wasserman.
I wanted to see.
So I think that the technology outed me. But what my real activity is these days, which is taking pictures of the flowers that my wife grows in her garden, hadn't intended that. We're going to have to rescind this.
But his desktop, it's more cluttered than my own.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. So we're running behind time, and in the interest of saving time, I'm not going to tell you my background and my CV. It doesn't matter anyway. The only thing that matters is if I have anything useful to tell you in the next few minutes. If you're interested in my CV, just Google the Idea Factory, and it's on there. You get an idea of what I'm interested in as we go through here. I'm going to talk to you about cultures of innovation and innovation in education, starting today with cultures of innovation. Well, we've been in the innovation game for a long time. See, the thing about innovation is, once you put it out in the world, it does what it wants to. You don't really manage or control innovation. I'm sure that in preparation for today, all of you have read 117 million entries on innovation on Google, and you've looked at all of the frameworks, and all of the adoption cycles, and all of the matrices and models, and all of the diffusion cycles, and you learned all about incremental versus disruptive innovation. And you know that there are three types of innovation, except that when there are 10 types of innovation, and that creativity is innovation, except when it isn't. So with that preparation, you know, I think we can kind of move to the master's class here. Everybody wants to know what's going to happen next. What's the big next thing? So Time Magazine, this just the past 2 months, Time Magazine has talk about the 10 ideas that are changing the world, and then there's the ideas that will change the world, could change the world, and are about to change the world. So you just read all that stuff and you'll know what's going to happen, except that you'll be wrong. You know, you can tell me what's going to happen in the future, but don't bother, because that's not going to happen that way, because there are going to be intervening events. sociological, technological, economic. It's just not going to turn out that way. Here's the best you can do. Tell me what the forces are that are going to create change in the future. Things like green and sustainability, this is stuff that's going to be around for generations, and we know it. Energy and water and web 2.0 whatever, and globalization and multi-localization, those are the forces that are going to create change. So what I need to do, whether I'm in education, whether I'm in production, whether I'm in extraction, whether I'm, you know, whatever business I'm in, a service business, I need to align my innovation investment with those forces of change. Forget about how it's going to turn out. You don't know. Here are companies and organizations that have really gotten good at this game in various sectors. See, but what they do is all utterly different from one another. Innovation is not like chocolate sauce. You just spread it on everything and it makes everything taste better. Every organization has its own flavor of innovation. So, like Dell Computer, innovation, they direct their innovation investment. They optimize it around inexpensive and direct marketing direct to the consumer. They optimize all their innovation around that. Apple optimizes all of its innovations around product design. Google optimizes all of its innovation around either creating new industries or changing the game in existing industries in the new media space. So what you have to understand is what is the optimization strategy for innovation in your organization? That's the job. Well, you see the U.S. Navy on there. The U.S. Navy is the greatest educational institution in the world. U.S. Navy optimizes innovation around force readiness, training, teamwork, and perpetual education for everybody in the Navy. Who'd have thought? This, I think, is required reading every year, Business Week. If you're really interested in innovation, there's kind of a set of required readings. This is one of them. You'll see this tag. I will give, I'll give Norman the names of these things in case it turns out that people are interested in. Just every year, Business Week's most innovative companies, read this stuff because they are really excellent little kind of snippets about how each of these companies is innovative. Not just that it is, but how they go about it. 5 years ago, Business Week published a, if you're only going to read one thing on innovation, you've got to get into the innovation universe. Read Business Week and Business Week's Innovation Online magazine. That's it. That will link you to everything else. So I would read this anniversary issue of 5 years ago. This is a pretty good definition of innovation. It's a kind of conceptual definition. And it comes from this report, 5 years old, that was published in the United States. You know, every nation, Canada included, has its new innovation initiative, its new innovation policy. Well, this was the one for the U.S., and it's really a good one. Of course, we didn't pay any attention to it. Right? And you may not pay any attention to yours either. But tomorrow I'm going to talk about some nations that are paying attention to it and what that does for them. People write these, they're brilliant documents, deeply researched, profoundly understood, and then the nations don't pay any attention to them. That's too bad. Do better. This is my more operational definition of innovation. Creativity directed toward purpose, producing value, and adopted at scale. And these are the operative terms. Directing creativity. You don't have to worry about making people creative or making students creative. We come wired that way. That's how we're built. That's who we are. What you have to do is how to learn how to get out of the way. How do you direct creativity toward purpose? What is it we're trying to do? To create value. I want that. And And then it has to be adopted in scale or in other words, it has to be out in the world so that it makes change and makes a difference for people in their lives. Usually when people think about innovation, they think about things, cool stuff. And that certainly is a type of innovation. And that's great, and that's the world I come from. My background is industrial design, new product development. So I've been designing cool stuff for 50 years. I really love to design cool stuff. But in the past 50 years, particularly in the past 20 years, the way I design cool stuff has emerged as having intrinsic value of its own, the process called design thinking. What you're going to hear and what you're going to read and what you're going to encounter if you get into the innovation space is a kind of mashup of design and innovation used almost interchangeably. In fact, Business Week decided not even to try to differentiate them. When you read their online column, you'll find examples and the stories that they're talking about. You can't tell where innovation stops and design starts. Design thinking is the DNA of innovation. So I'm going to talk about the
interesting
process for creative resolution of problems. It's not critical thinking. It's about the creative building up of ideas. It's generative. And it's, guess what you're doing today, which is outside the box thinking. That's you're doing step one of design thinking today. It has seven stages. These are the classic stages. This comes from work done in 1969, published in 1969 by Howard Simon, who is the creator of the field of artificial intelligence. This is how you go about it. They're not linear, they're iterative. I just want to bookmark this. This is a great book to read. Published 1969, still in print, The Sciences of the Artificial. These are the foundations, this is the foundation of design thinking that all the rest of us have built on ever since. And you are about to start to build on now. Here are the values that underlie design thinking. And you will find that they are the same critical thinking skills that everyone says you need to inculcate in 21st century education. Creativity, ambidextrous thinking, that means thinking with both sides of your mind. Teamwork, end user focus, that means thinking about outcomes for people, and curiosity. There's a lot of academic interest on this subject. There's lots of reading available. Just Google it. Google design thinking. Hundreds of thousands of entries on design thinking. Interesting thing about design thinking is it's scalable. You can apply it to products and services and communications and environments, which is what I've done most of my life. But these days, I'm applying it up there to the design of organizations and social programs and large-scale public policy, actually to the redesign of nation states in scale. But all of those scales don't take the same amount of time. To get adoption at scale for a new product or service takes about 9 to 24 months these days. It used to take 3 years. A new strategy takes 2 to 3 years. Transforming an organization takes 3 to 5 years. Social programs, 5 to 7 years. That's in a nation where innovation is an embedded practice. Otherwise, it takes you forever and ever. Same thing with national policies. National policies in innovation-driven nations these days take 7 to 10 years for fundamental transformation. And I'll give you some examples of those tomorrow. Here is an example of a nation that 12 years ago, 1996, decided they would no longer be the world sweatshop. They would no longer just be the offshore manufacturer of cheap products. That they would reposition themselves, which means you don't just say, I am an innovation, a leading innovation design-driven economy. You don't just say that and it happens. You have to then do it. So they did it. And now they are considered Korea as cool, and the products that come out of Korea are cool and transformative and trend-making. Samsung is the poster child for this. Samsung used to be an anonymous offshore no brand manufacturer. It's now along with Sony, the top electronic brand in the world. They make 21% of Korea's gross national product. I mean, if you want a report card for innovation, that's a pretty good one. And this is how they did it. They took the yin-yang symbol of their flag, and they said, yin-yang. This is the combination of, this means whole mind thinking, the balance of reason and feeling. What a lovely idea. So the way they approach products that makes their products special is they look not only at the technology, you know, and the functionality, but also the emotional, the humanistic dimensions. And that comes through in everything they do. Made a heavy investment in design, research and development, retrained all their designers, sent them all to a completely new school that they invented themselves, and now are, as they say, one of the top design brands in the world, and Korea is one of the top innovation nations in the world in 10 years. Actually, they really emerged like after 6 years. That's pretty fast, and everyone else in Asia is trying to follow their mind. Which is why China now has 400 design schools graduating 8,000 people like me a year. I'm glad I'm not in the job market anymore. It's terrifying, I tell you. And almost all these schools are new within the past 10, 20 years. They're turning out 10,000 new media designers a year. Now this is a critical mass, a force for innovation that's going to very quickly transform China from an offshore manufacturing sweatshop to an innovation-driven, high-value-added nation. It's just happening right before our eyes, and it's just astonishing what's going on. So when I think about the state of art of design thinking today, it's what I call not just innovation, but human-centered innovation. We really have to keep pointing ourselves to that. Not technology-driven innovation, human-centered innovation. I'll just call it HCR. This is where it came from. In the 1950s, this is what engineers thought a personal computer would look like. Here, take a look at this. This is the home computer for 2004. This thing. Okay. It has a teletype interface, and you use the Fortran when you take a program. You use Fortran, which makes it easy to use. You notice up in the corner here that television set stuck up there? That's the screen. And this is what you operate. I have no idea what the big wheel is. I can't imagine. Yeah, but I'm turning it over. We weren't going to get there that way. So that's why we had to reinvent how innovation got done. And this is the guy we reinvented, Alan Kay, in the late 1960s and early 1970s, computer scientist. He established all the fundamental behind this and behind every device you carry around the screen. And here's how he did it. He didn't look at the technology, because the technology to do anything really interesting would fill this room at the time. So instead he watched kids play, gave himself to play with kids. He watched them play with an Etch-a-Sketch. You know, Etch-a-Sketch, he writes it on, lift the screen, and it goes. And he said, that's what a computer should do. This was 1969, 1970. No computer in the world could do that. No, there wasn't computational power to do that. And there weren't programs to do that. He made this incredible leap of imagination. And he said, the only way to predict the future is create it. Let's go to work on it. Now, he happened to work at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, where I spent a lot of time. And they took that sketch and they said, let's build a machine that kind of does what Alan said, that has objects and you move icons around, you kind of move stuff around, instead of command-line language, like old IBM stuff. This was called the Xerox Alto, And they created this in 1980, and when I became head of design at Xerox, I had one of these on my desk. It was one of only 10 that existed in the world. We were connected together by something called ARPANET, which became Ethernet. And so this was the first, first hand-built bench model to try to do some of the stuff that Alan was saying we ought to be able to do. It kind of work directly with objects and things. And then Macintosh came out in 1984 and was exactly what I had on my desk, except they commercialized it and they made it a computer for the rest of it. And then Windows, of course, adopted it, and it continues to evolve. And how many have one of these in your pocket? And now we can do what Alan said we should be able to do, and it all came from that. That's the shift, making from the product, from the technology out in the world normatively, and making it imaginatively into how things really should be by watching what people do. Sorry. I'll get to the microphone, got excited. You don't just sit around and imagine yourself unless you're a solitary genius. But for us normal, you know, carbon-based terrestrial beings, the best thing to do is go out and watch what people do. That's where you get the idea. So this HCI stuff, this is how it works. This is what it looks like. Here's the process. I'm going to go through this really rapidly. Anybody who's interested in knowing more about this, there are ways to get a hold of me and we can talk more about this. But you do it from outside in, Alan. Outside in, not inside out. You imagine the future and work back from there. You create strategic scenarios of what that future ought to be like. You go out and watch people. You create personas, which are individuals that represent the main segments of the people you want to reach. And you tell stories about them, and you do that together with the people, not just alone. And you do it with lots of other people who are different from you. Then you prototype, assess, learn, iterate. And that's how it is. Now, there's a model for this. Everybody's got a model. Total process model, right? And those are the main four steps. Within there, you do these activities. Sorry. Today, you are here. That's where you are on the model. You're going to go out and look at things differently. You're in discussion. When you really get good at this, then you will have mastered a kind of set of design tools. Know how to work in interdisciplinary teams, how to benchmark what other people are doing. You'll have all this kind of stuff that you'll learn how to do. And then you use that process to connect insight about people to foresight about products. When I say products, I mean products, services, programs, policies, the output. And you do it again, and you do it again. You have to do it three times. Don't know why, law of nature. I'd be glad to describe to you why you have to iterate three times what you do in order to execute to get adoption at scale. That's how to do this. Got it? Here's what some of the activities look like inside of that when you're really doing it. You look at forces of change, you know, things like macroeconomic development, water wars. You look at things that possibly could happen, you know, like peak oil. And you create future strategic scenarios, 7, 10, 15, 20 year scenarios into the future. And you put them on models like this. You describe future worlds where you're going to have to be successful in whatever you do. That's how you look at the world at the macro level. That becomes the background for everything that you think about when you do this design thinking. Here's the foreground. The front stage, you look at individual people. What does she do? What does she have to say? What's she thinking? How she feels. What's her state of mind? What influences and motivates her? All of that sociocultural context. This is not work just done by me. I've done some modification of this, but a lot of this work, I sit on a panel. That I don't stand on the shoulders of people because that would hurt them. I stand shoulder to shoulder with people. A lot of smart people. This is not, who's read the The Little Prince. This is not un serpent qui a avalé an elephant. This is a normal distribution bell curve. And this is who we used to try to find as the target for our innovation, the mass market. Well, it turns out the mass market never lived. It, you know, didn't exist. This is a statistical artifact. And today, nobody tries to find the mass market anyway, because that center line is moving so fast in one direction or another, you'd always be behind the target. What we do is we look at the tails. We look at the edges. We look at people who are sort of outliers for new lifestyles and new habits, and new practices, and new interests. And the mantra is, manage for the edges. Manage for strange people. Right? And the mass will take care of itself. This is something important to keep in mind when you're thinking about education, because we keep thinking about, you know, what's the chocolate sauce that we can spread over everything? There isn't one. It's got to be highly differential, because people are highly differential like this. So at the ground level, we look at very specific, particular people who represent different ways of being in the world, different interests, different groups, not demographic groups, but lifestyle interest groups, capability groups. And we go out with them, and we live their lives with them, and we watch Todd and Catherine and Richard and Alan and Allison, and we go through and we infiltrate into their lives. Then we come back and we build a whole theater of them and persona maps that recreate their world to bring them to life, so that we have particular specific people with specific needs, wants, interests, motivators, and influencers to design for, instead of some big, you know, non-existent mush of mass markets. We tell stories by creating storyboards and user scenarios. We even create whole worlds where we will take, let's say, 200 senior executives of a corporation for 3 days into the world of 2015. Have them experience it and meet the people who live there. This is what our working environment looks like. It's a mess. Looks like a design studio. But everybody we work with winds up working this way. Highly visual.
Can I ask you to explain charrette team? I've never come across that.
Oh, charrette. Une charrette. For those who are francophone, you know, is a small horse-drawn cart, right? A little cart. So in the 18th and 19th century, the French government gave out lots of commissions for people to design a new city gate, new monuments to somebody, design the Panthéon, you know, whatever. And architects would work. Architectural teams would work night and day and night and day in their little lofts up on the third floor of some house, and they would work and this is what it would look like up there. They would work and work, and then at the morning of the judging, this charrette would come trundling through the cobblestone streets as the sun was coming up, and the architects would lean out from the third floor loft, and they would drop their drawings into the charrette, and the drawings would be taken off to the judging. Sometimes they weren't even finished with the drawing, so they'd leap into the cart. And he'd be working on the drawings. And this became known as being en charrette. So the idea of charrette is a term that we use in design and in architecture to mean very intensive, very time-compressed, very outcome-oriented, collaborative work session where nobody gets to sleep. You only get to eat flat food that can be slid under the door. Pizzas and crepes, and that's all you get. That's all he gets to go home until he's done. That's a charrette. The culture of the charrette is really central to design thinking. We can expand a lot on that, but anyway. Try it, it's fun. It's crazy and fun. There are two types of cultures. One is called the spec culture, the specification culture, and the other is called the prototyping culture. The prototyping culture is the one we want. Trial and error, don't know how to turn up, don't know if this is right, try that again. Spec culture is somebody, a highly detailed description, and you just execute it. It's kind of algorithmic, you just press the button, and it comes out. There are certain things that I want to have come from specification culture. For example, the General Electric jet engine that I'm going to sit next to when I fly back to San Francisco, I would like to come from from specification culture. This is the best book on prototyping culture by my friend Michael Schrader. He says that innovative organizations don't produce innovative prototypes. Innovative prototyping produces innovative organizations. It's a little bit like cognitive therapy. You know, just do it. Just do something, and it will change how you think. It will change how you are. Innovators play with models, creative play. Michael called it creative play. And how you play with prototypes matters more than how you systematically plan. Now here's an inconvenient truth. You can't do new stuff unless you redesign your organization. It just doesn't work. It doesn't stick. You can say, we're going to do this project innovatively. We're going to introduce this innovative program. If you're not an innovative organization, it's not going to happen. You have some weekends, you do some sessions like this, you have some nice weekend retreats, it won't stick. Another really good book is by my friend Bob Sutton at Stanford. He says that design thinking happens in an organization that is never finished. You know, an organization, finished organization that does new creative stuff is an non sequitur. It doesn't happen. You have to continually renew the organization the same way, using the same techniques, the same thinking skills that you use to generate new innovative stuff. So that model that I showed you has a substructure, and the substructure is the organization itself. So in those iterations, you have to have people, purpose, program, plans, place to work, and practices that are optimized for discovery. The same thing again for design and development. The same thing again for delivering it out into the world. And those aren't the same. You've got to design an organization around what it's trying to do. These are the capacities that you have to build in innovation. Here's the state of the art now. Here's where we are. The new human-centered innovation is different in absolutely crucial ways from the old ways we innovated and the old ways we designed. Here's some of them. Used to be we were driven by products. Now we're driven by process. We care now about the user's experience. The customer is at the center of everything. It's not our way. Take it or leave it. It's your way. Can I figure out what you want? Thinking from outside backward into the organization, having a prototyping culture. We now have dispersed virtual flex time organizations. Where is the organization? You don't even know what an American corporation is anymore. People set up or all overseas, make their profits overseas, and have their operations overseas. It's all about networks and hierarchy and open collaboration. The sciences for now are social science, ecology, biology, human systems, life cycle, economics. Let me put in a little apology. I'm not saying everything on the left side is over. Think of it more as a sliding scale. These aren't polar opposites, where the right side replaces the left side. Rather, the right side amplifies the left side. course, we still need physical sciences, engineering, and all the rest of that. And you don't have a business if you don't maximize shareholder wealth. What we've learned is that the way to maximize shareholder wealth is to maximize human benefit. Leap into the future and think backwards about how to get there. We have flexible manufacturing, mass customization, fast continuous improvement, the Japanese call it Kaizen. Everything is done by interdisciplinary teams. Everything is now international, global, and multilocal. You don't think about a single thing, you think about platforms, passions, intentions. You co-create and you co-design with users and customers. Now, I'm giving you rules here, principles that really come out of the world of industry, primarily. But just take industry out and plug policy, public policy in. Take iPod out and plug, you know, teaching science in. It still all applies. I know, because I've been doing that for the past 10 years. Working on this way of innovating in education and healthcare and national defense. You know, big public policy areas. Everything's programmable, intelligence, and networked. Everything has to be green, recyclable, and sustainable, small, fast, and light. We're inventing new materials as I speak. Everything is made all over the world, and everybody can use design thinking, not just for the experts. It's for making everything. Experiences, ventures, organizations, public policies. We used to think that more of everything was better. No, better is better. Take waste culture. This one, the left side, is over. China doesn't know it yet. Actually, China does know it. Sorry, China doesn't know it yet. Actually, China does know it. It's just they've made a strategic decision. We're going to do the left side until we get to a certain level. Well, they are absolutely going to the right side. The next industrial revolution and the triple bottom line. Well, let me repeat that. Here is what you are preparing students for living in a world where all the productions of material culture and the organizations that produce them work on a triple bottom line: economic value, yep, social value, and environmental value, and figuring out what those mean and how to do it. That's it. We're in it now. We're on the launch pad. We're inventing it. And this is where it started. June 1st, 2006, publication and the release of this book and the release of that film. From green doesn't sell in 24 months. That was the mantra. I don't know how long I've tried to develop sustainable products, and the manufacturers always said, green doesn't sell. It's not a recognizable value. In 24 months, now everything, in case you haven't read a magazine or looked at television or looked at the internet lately, everything is clean air and stop climate change and green building construction, sustainable everything. Green sells. So we innovated ourselves into something of a mess. We're going to innovate ourselves, I promise. You heard it here. So I want to leave you with these thoughts. The only purpose of an organization is innovation. It's not just a few people. It's just on the internet. It's just for a project. That's the only purpose of an organization. Peter Drucker is the founder of Management Science. You don't have to wait for permission. Innovation doesn't travel up and down hierarchies anymore. It propagates laterally because of Web 2.0. Web 2.0 social media changes everything about who can innovate and how you can do it. And here's a great book on that.
Here comes, I want to get that book.
It's in my hotel room, actually.
Peter Drucker said this. Alan Kay said it. He always quoted Peter Drucker. This is too important to leave to experts like me. You do it. It's not what innovators do, it's what customers adopt. You can all learn design thinking. It's not about individual creative genius. It's about social organization, collaboration, having mind, methods, and techniques, and tools. All learnable by you and by students. In other words, as you go out today, this is another thing. Those operative terms you might keep in mind. Where's the creativity going on besides your business? How is it being directed? What's the purpose, the stated and understood purpose in this place? What's the value that's being produced that people can recognize? And how are they getting, how is it being adopted and scaled? That's worth repeating. I don't know how many clients I've had who said, you know, change everything except us. Change everything except the organization. I say, goodbye. Ask me a different question. You have to build these capacities in an organization where nothing's going to happen. You have to be people-centered. You have to be working on constantly building up insight about customers and walking in their shoes. You have to be constantly leaping into the future, trying to understand what is going on and what could happen that could affect the enterprise and how the enterprise needs to adapt to that. It has to be collaborative, it has to be generative, it has to be an idea factory. Tomorrow we'll talk about innovation in education. Thank you. Have fun today.
So that was Arnold Wasserman from the Idea Factory in San Francisco talking about design thinking as well as a whole bunch of other ideas. Afterwards, I had had a chance to sit down with Arnold and talk with him at some length about his ideas. And the question I put to him was, you know, given the constraints that I have to work with, which is I have a classroom where students come for an hour every day. I have a curriculum mandated by the Ministry of Education that I must begin and finish it within a certain time frame, and I can't cut anything or leave anything out. How can I, given those constraints, which can be creative constraints, because I think creativity takes place within certain boundaries. When there's no boundaries, it's difficult to be creative. I think you get more chaos rather than creativity. So within those boundaries, I said, Mr. Wasserman, what can you suggest to me about ways that I can use design thinking to make what I do in the classroom a little more effective? His reply, and I'm paraphrasing him now, and I hope I'm not doing him an injustice, but he basically said that I'm asking the wrong question. And I said, well, what is the right question? And his reply was, well, you can't do innovation in the environment that you're working in because your organization really has to first get on board with being committed towards innovation, and the constraints you described don't allow for that. I disagree with that. I think I can be innovative, and I think I have been innovative within those constraints, and I think there is room for design thinking applied to the context of the classroom. It's too bad we didn't get a chance to continue the conversation further because I had to go to another one of the conference sessions. Anyways, I'd love to hear your thoughts about what role you think design thinking might play in the classroom, and how can we, within the constraints we have within our classrooms, apply those kinds of notions.